Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrio.
And I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn in graduate school.
Hello, everyone. Hope you had a great week. We're excited to bring you this episode today. Alex, here's a fun question for you. What is the weirdest food you've ever eaten?
Probably a durian. A durian. It's like an evil pineapple from Singapore.
I thought you were going to say that's a Pokemon. That sounded more like a...
It probably is a Pokemon, too. Got to catch them all. It's like this giant kind of hard, spiky food that, and then you cut it open. I think it's a fruit, but I don't really know. And when you cut it open, it smells like rotting meat. Oh. Actually, in Singapore, if you eat it on the subway, you get like a $500 fine, or well, I don't know, the $500 equivalent fine.
Is it
fine.
Sweet?
Oh, because it smells so bad.
It's like nutty, and I don't know. I was not a fan of it, but I had it in ice cream, and it was like pretty good in ice cream. But when I just ate it like raw, it was... I think it's an acquired taste.
Okay.
Yeah. What about you, Sebastian? What's the weirdest?
It has to be fried scorpion. So I was in Beijing, and there's like an area where you can eat, in theory, quote unquote, weird foods. But I mean, weird for us Westerners or whatever.
Right.
And it's just like a bunch of options. And there were seahorses and scorpions. So I tried the scorpions. And it's like essentially very fried. It basically tastes like popcorn, which is interesting because it's like, oh, duh, right? Like it's just like popped, like shell. But you see them alive, like before they before they cook them, and then they cook them alive.
That's
it's
sadistic.
It is bad. I think, you know, this is an age in my time where, you know, the word vegetarian and veganism did not exist in my vocabulary. Now, obviously after the fact, it feels a little bit different.
But it's insane.
It's the worst things. What about you, Dania?
I don't know. Well, you guys are much more adventurous than I am, I would say. Right? I haven't
chicken
eaten a
thigh
lot of...
or something.
right, exactly. It's like, that's it. I had an orange. No. Yeah, weirdest. I don't know. I guess, you know, more out of my realm was younger, never having had eel before.
Eel
when I was in Japan, and that was delicious. But yeah, so it's not very weird to people nowadays who... eat a lot of sushi or something.
I think my parents would find that pretty weird.
There's probably a lot of people. So actually 40% of our listeners are international. So there's probably a breadth of people who haven't tried eel yet. Mm-hmm. So give me that. All right, great. So reveal, our special guest today is Dania Francis. She's an assistant professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Her current research involves using experimental and quasi-experimental methods to identify structural causes of racial and socioeconomic academic achievement gaps. She received her doctorate from Duke University and holds a master's degree from Harvard and a bachelor's degree from Smith College. She's also a board member of the National Economic Association, which is part of the topic that we'll talk about today, and a National Academies of Education / Spencer Foundation postdoctoral fellowship. These are all really good things. How are you doing today?
I'm all right. I suppose we should mention that it's post-election day.
This is right.
Yeah, filled with a little bit of angst, anxiety, and just overall just wait and see.
Yeah.
Just in case this stretches out for weeks, it's Wednesday, November 4th.
So. Right.
But we don't know when this podcast has come in, but if there is no current president and if everything is, you know, not in the ways that things are supposed to be, then maybe this podcast will never actually air. Who knows?
I have eaten a lot of Halloween candy that I was unable to give to students. I normally am in the past 24 hours.
I stress eat if that's my thing that I do. So I had pizza and ice cream sandwich, which was fantastic. Highly recommend.
I like that.
So we like to ask our guests to share a fun fact about themselves. What would be your shareable fun fact?
A fun fact. So, I don't know if it's fun so much as weird. I don't know. I can say all 50 states in alphabetical order in less than half a minute, less than 30 seconds.
Okay,
I mean, we have to ask.
We have to ask.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
You kind of set yourself up there.
Two, one, go.
Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Hawaii, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, North Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Vermont, Virginia, Washington, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Wyoming.
Fancy.
That is great. Where did you, why did you, and all the questions?
We had to sing a song called 50 Nifty United States in elementary school. And part of the song is like this, like really like musical way to say them. And so you learn things by music, I guess. And it just so sticks with you.
I love that. That's a great
It was so fast. I'm 100% unable to verify. You could have like slipped in.
Well,
like,
our listeners will be able to, to verify it because they'll see if it's actually a minute. So
exactly.
You'll get called out on Twitter if it was.
Right. Like you didn't do
the
it.
People in Idaho will be like, excuse me.
Yeah.
All right. So before we dive into today's topic, we love to talk about some paper or project or anything that you'd like to promote. So is there anything you want to share with us today?
Yeah, that's awesome. So, I mean, I guess maybe I'll try to make this a quick threefer. I have a series of papers that I look at the explanations for under-enrollment of minority students in advanced placement calculus courses. This is an important course because it's a gateway to STEM majors and careers in STEM. And so in one paper that's in 2019, the BE Journal of Economic Analysis and Policy, we do an audit experiment where we ask school counselors to say whether or not they would recommend a particular transcript of a student for advanced placement calculus. And all we change is the race and gender of the name on the top of the transcript. And some of our results indicate that it is much harder for Black female students to be recommended for advanced placement calculus, even when they have the same academic record. A quick second paper, which is in the Journal of Economics, Race, and Policy, is a theoretical paper. The first paper is co-authored with Angela de Oliveira and Carrie Dimmitt at UMass Amherst. The second paper is co-authored with Sandy Darity, and we look at, it's a theoretical treatment of the same question, and it's kind of meant as a bit of a rebuttal to Austin Smith and Friars' 2004 theory paper on the acting white hypothesis in the QJE. So if you like a little bit of controversy, tune into that one. And then the third paper is actually forthcoming with a Russell Sage Journal, and it's also co-authored with Sandy Darity, and we use North Carolina data and do an empirical analysis of whether or not Black students are more or less likely to take advanced placement math courses by the time they graduate as a function of the percentage of Black students who are in those classes when they arrive on high school campus as a ninth grader. Right. So if they observe, racial segregation within schools when they arrive on campus, does that influence their own perceptions and whether or not they eventually take those classes themselves?
And the answer is yes.
The answer is yes. Right. Okay. You are 22% more likely to take an AP math course if there's a 1 percentage point increase in the share of Black students in those courses.
Wow.
That sounds like an awesome research agenda, very compact and like really policy relevant. My question was, I think it was really cool that you're focusing on school counselors, but I'm not sure, like, I think that's the right population to focus on too, but I'm not sure like what I should expect. Do you think they're going to be more prone to sort of like misclassifying people or less than like other people, other people who might recommend like parents or like other people at the school?
Yeah, that's a good question, right? So your teachers may know you best, right? And so the teachers may be your teachers and your parents may know you best, and they may be the best person to help with that. But in a lot of school environments, the school counselor has this authority, right? And even when they don't have this, supreme authority, they do have the ability to encourage or discourage people to take certain classes, right? Mm-hmm. So in some cases, they're this sort of maybe backstop. I wouldn't call them gatekeepers, but this backstop of who gets recommended and who doesn't, even when it is maybe up to the students themselves.
Right? Oh yeah, I wasn't trying to suggest that they're not a really important group to like look at because they don't have like power or authority. I just meant like, do you think like the effect, like the discrimination effect or whatever you're calling it, would be like larger with them or like larger with other groups? I just, or maybe it's like irrelevant because this is the target group. So why does it matter what like the effect would be if you did the same sort of experiment with other people?
No, that's a good question. Yeah. I mean, I think to some extent it matters who you pay the most attention to, right? Who do you respect the most? Whose opinion do you matters to you the most? And you know, to some extent, if that's, you know, more likely to be your parents or your teachers, then that's who we should target.
Was there like a group or some of the characteristics about the school counselors that where there was no effect, differential effect? Can you look at that? I guess maybe it's a power issue.
Yeah, that's a great question. So in our current study, it's a power issue, right? Because get this, the school counseling profession is about 77% women and a similar 70 something percent white. And so, you know, to find, you know, counselors who
there's
were
not all
you know, black or right. Yeah, right. Exactly. It's,
yeah.
You know, very difficult. So.
That's super interesting. And are you continuing this line of work or is this like a trilogy? And or there's going to be more papers on this topic.
So we're hoping to do a more nationally representative and nationally recruited sample of the audit study. And so we will expand that, put more bells and whistles in it. We kind of thought of the first paper as a bit of a pilot project. So
that's awesome.
There will be more.
Hopefully if somebody gives more money to Dania, that she could follow the other people throughout, because I would be super interested.
Yay!
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, to see how they change across time with students and things. Yeah, that'd be great.
Make that cash flow. All right.
Now we'll switch over to the next segment, which is where that's sort of a new thing that we've been doing where we talk about people's workflow. This is really broad. It's not meant to be anything specific, but we just love to know what your day-to-day work like. And you could think about like, there could be an idealized one or a teaching day workflow or a research day or summer, but the spirit of this is basically
COVID day workflow.
Yeah. Or an election day workflow.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, which drink are you next?
Yeah.
But you know, some people think about apps. Some people like to know how to approach your day, structuring it, just sort of whatever you'd like to discuss on this topic. We'd love to hear.
Yeah, there's definitely an ideal versus a reality for me, right? Like in my ideal, I actually get something done. But so I teach right now, this semester I teach on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And so I definitely try to block off Tuesdays and Thursdays as my work day. Yeah, this is my when I do research. And I try to make sure to do that either. The thing that I haven't gotten into doing, which I really want to do, is then also start to really block off time in the calendar as if it's an appointment, right? Mm-hmm. I think that would help me, because what happens is on Thursdays, because I've worked so hard on Monday, Wednesday, Friday doing, you know, teaching and service, Thursdays I'm like, I'm so tired, right? Like, I don't want to do this.
Right.
I'll do the laundry. That has to get done too, right? Like all those things.
Yeah.
It creeps in. But when I am able to stay on track, I have times when I get, you know, blocks and it's like, I can't, you know, a task maybe seems so insurmountable when really it's not, but in my mind, I just don't even want to start it.
Yes.
And so, right. And you're just, and then, you know, 2 days before it's due. And then you're like, right, oh, look, exactly. I had all this time.
Oh, I have to do it now.
Right? Yeah, now I have to do it. Exactly. So what has been helping me recently was doing that, a lot of people have been, what is it called? The facultyw.org.
National I've done Center that.
For, yeah. Yeah. So
it's NFCDD, right? The National.
Yeah, Forum. That's right.
Wait, what is this? I was like, you guys just say abbreviations. I don't even know what it is.
I know. We just start throwing out acronyms, right? Yeah. No, so it's
National Center for Faculty Development and Diversity. And then you're right that the website is facultydiversity.org.
Perfect. And so sometimes like there's a cost to some of the things that they offer, but some universities subscribe to it and they do, you know, boot camps to help you do things with productivity and planning out your day and time, you know, time journaling and things like that. But they also just have some really good advice about, you know, getting over hurdles like that, like just saying, hey, do 30 minutes today of something for your research. And so with me, it's a good trick because in my mind, I can say, like, I cannot write this literature review. It's just not going to happen, right? It's like the thing I'm dreading. And if I say, okay, I'll spend 30 minutes at least just writing an outline of the literature review. And then before I know it, I look up and I'm like, oh, look, I did half of it, because it was just the getting started and giving myself permission to stop that was keeping me from doing it. So
that's interesting.
I do that. I have to trick myself into work.
And what is a part of the job research-wise, in the research part of that you really enjoy the most?
Oh, I really like data analysis, which is kind of nerdy, right? Like, so I like sitting down and coding and thinking about, you know, how should this look? What should I be doing with that? And if you have, like, the first part that I write on any paper, I'll write the data and methods section because it's like, okay, that's, I got that, right? Like that, I can just, and, you know, check mark that part's done. And then lit review and framing, right? It's just, it's framing.
Yeah.
That's the,
it's an art
for me, like the hardest. It is. It is.
You know, and so, which is, which you have to be in a mood. I thought we were in science, but
yeah, no,
and I'm not yeah,
exactly.
No, we're in performance arts.
Especially. We're performance art. Got it. I mean, for presentation, this is so true, right?
And
I,
then reviewer number two will say, ah, the framing, I don't know.
Right. Yeah, no, totally. So, and what about you wake up on a Tuesday? How do you know what you're going to work on? Is it, are you working in a pretty sequential kind of projects or you're a bunch of things are in the stoves?
Yeah. So I tend to have a lot of things going at once. And, but I do, I'm a checklist. So I will have, even for each project, you know, it depends. Some days I'll just have a checklist for the day. But sometimes if I'm really involved in a lot of things, I'll have a checklist for each project. And then I'll just kind of say like, okay, let me just look and see, right? Like what's on deck. And then because I feel so good about checking something off, right?
Totally.
Even if it's something small.
The dopamine is there.
Yeah, exactly.
So I actually have a question on that. So you've got these like master checklists that like live somewhere for each project. And do you think of each day, like scan them all? Or do you like have some idea of like, ah, like Tuesday I need to be working on this. And then you look at that particular project. You're like, I'm going to work on this. So on this project, what do I do?
No, I scan them all because I try to keep as little in my head as possible because that's a bad thing. If, like, if I have to rely on it being in my head, it's not going to get done, right? Like, so I do. I've gone back and forth between my checklist being digital and me just having a really solid journal book where I, you know, have tabs for each project. And then I just like can go through and flip through. Sometimes when I'm not getting things done, I just go back old school. Right. And go back to that journal because, you know, I'm like the digital is getting distracting because I'm opening up other things while I should be looking at the checklist. But yeah, so having to scan and look and say, okay, I'll do this.
Right. That's interesting. And what is there like a change or something that you are like looking forward to improving on your next step of productivity, let's say?
Oh yeah. No, I definitely less distracted with, email, Twitter,
right.
Like things like that.
Right. Cause you were saying that blocking time, right? Cause you were saying like, you're starting to use your calendar a little bit more. Right. Right.
It'd be
like,
that's
this
right.
is my sacred non, you know, internet time, I guess. Kind
of. That's exactly right. And, you know, even now that we're home because of, you know, it's, I'll go do the dishes. I'll go,
right,
like do the laundry, whatever else I can see that isn't the work I need to be doing.
Right. Absolutely. That's we're very similar stages for sure. Alex had he uses us for blocking that he recommended last week, right? Was it called?
So it's called, I don't know, it's like for, actually you mentioned before we started recording that you use Apple products. So it's for a Mac. It's called Self-Control. I don't know, maybe it's like installing ransomware on my computer or something, but it turns off my ability to access like a whole bunch of different websites because I have no control. So like I if I buy cookies or something at the grocery store, like I'm gonna eat all of the cookies. So like, the only way I can prevent that is like just not purchase
them. Don't buy them.
So yeah.
I wrote that down.
Yeah.
I wrote that down. That's good. Okay. Yeah.
I don't think there's an equivalent on your phone. Unfortunately, Apple's blocking app is too easy to circumvent by just being like, "Yeah, I'm done. Get out of here." So
okay.
The other thing I've done recently in COVID times is my grad school roommate. His name is James Harrison. Shout out to him. He's a professor at the Naval Academy. I sent him like a message, being like, "Hey, work session," and we have like an hour to an hour and a half. Like work session where, you know, we catch up for like 10 minutes and then we're both there. We're literally not talking. We're literally just working. And like, you know, it works, I would say like 70% of the time. I think like 30% of the time, like I'm just like not in the mood and like no matter what, I'm not going to work. But then there's a solid 70% of the time where the person is working, I'm going to be working too, you know, or like feel bad talking too much because he wants to work.
He's
and so then I'm
work.
Like, oh, I need to work. Right. So I think like a combo of those things has been, you know, working so far, but yeah.
I like that.
All right. So to recap, we've got use a calendar. Ideally, you'd be keeping appointments with yourself, but that's like a ideal versus reality right now. Time blocking across days and days. There's non-teaching days. And then some like tip sort of reducing resistance seemed to be the NCFDD, write, like pay yourself to write 30 minutes in the morning. First thing, giving yourself permission to stop at 30 minutes is an important thing as well. And then writing the data part first seemed to be a thing, just because it's sort of like you did the code, you like that part. So it seems like less resistance around writing up like the words around that code.
That's right.
But framing is really hard. And then a mat of checklists, whether they're analog or digital, scanned each day. And then you sort of pick what you're going to do with the time available on that day. And that focus is really important.
That's right. That sounds good.
That's amazing. I never heard of this NCCFD, and I'm looking at it right now. It looks really cool. Oh, 20K. Okay.
Yeah. So my university.
I didn't realize that. I thought it was going to be like $5 a month. And I was like, no. Like Netflix.
Oh, there are institutional memberships.
Yeah.
So if your university pays.
Oh, individual pricing, yeah. It says $500 a year. That's a little bit more reasonable. Yeah.
I also think we've used a different acronym for it every time we've talked about it. So I think that's great.
That's great. Okay, cool. Right. Well, I'll have to dig into this. So you like, is do you endorse this or like half endorse it?
I would endorse it. I've never done the boot camp, but they did a workshop on our campus before, and I've used some of their techniques.
Okay, got
it. I've done it like two or three times, and I did not get a lot out of it because I wasn't in a position where I had a lot of writing to do. And they now take a slightly, or like more recently when I've been engaged with them, they take a more broad definition of what constitutes writing to coding and stuff. Okay. But I have no problem spending 10 hours coding. I have a huge problem sitting down and writing strings of sentences in a row.
Yes. Yeah.
So like,
yeah.
I think it was the second time I did it, when I like actually had results and I had some papers that I needed to be writing, I found it very useful. Mm. And then you get paired with like non-economists, people all over, and that's both really helpful and frustrating. And I think part of the frustrating bit was like the grass is always greener. I think all of us were frustrated because the other person's to-do list seemed easier to them. But it was really nice to hear and talk with people from other fields. That was a really valuable component of it for me.
All right, so that's a great place to pause and shift topics to talk about the topic of the day. So we want to talk about the NEA, which is the National Economic Association. We want to talk about what the organization is and how it can help people in different parts of their career. So first, let's set up the stage. What is your involvement with the NEA, or how it started your involvement with the NEA?
So currently, I'm actually an NEA board member. I'm serving my second term. I think the terms for board members are 3 years. This is my second term. I actually re-upped because I enjoy it. I heard about and knew about the NEA to some extent as a grad student, in part because, my advisor, Sandy Darity at Duke, was very involved with the NEA. He's a past president. He's won the NEA's Westerfield Award, which is a prestigious award that we give out. I knew about it. I was not as involved until probably about, maybe a year into being an assistant professor. So I guess maybe, 5 years ago. And it's really been, I guess I would say, like, I feel like my career outlook, right, has improved after being involved with the NEA.
Do you think that's a function of like meeting lots of people and talking with them, or is there something unique about the NEA that's like helped improve your career outlook? I'm just wondering, like, features.
Yeah,
sometimes it's just like a network of people to have, right? So
let me put it like this. So I have always found, this is my own personal opinion, right, I have always found it in the past like a difficult thing to do to attend ASSA meetings I have, you know, I work on issues of race and discrimination. And let's face it, economics is a field that, you know, doesn't even like to sort of use the word discrimination. We prefer mm-hmm. to say everything else we can say before we say discrimination. And so I have often talking about my work in lots of circles at ASSA meetings, it's kind of like a hostile environment. Okay. So for me, for a long time, even just going to those meetings, it was like dreading, which is awful because they're kind of expensive to go to, right? Like you have to you build this up, but we have to go.
A professional society that you're in, you don't want to, like, that's not a good outcome if you're dreading.
Exactly. And if we kind of have
Lula
to go.
Palooza,
yeah.
And this should be Lollapalooza. You're right.
This should be Lollapalooza for everyone.
Right. And so then I started getting more involved with NEA and realized, oh, you know what? Like, well, the NEA has all these sessions at ASSA. Right. And I really, you know, kind of just dived more into the NEA sessions at ASSA and attending their research sessions, attending, you know, their happy hours, their networking events. And it was like so much more of an enjoyable experience for me. And so even presenting my papers at NEA sessions, the feedback is just as rigorous, right? Just as tough, but delivered like respectfully and with an air where it's like, we care about making your paper better for, right? Like this is a good idea you have and we want to help you make it
better. It's a growth mindset, right?
Yes, thank you. I like the way you said it. So it just felt so much more nurturing. And so I think for me, at least, I look forward now every year I'm excited to go to ASSA because it's like, oh, I get to see like this community of people who I know we are all interested in helping each other grow.
The question I was going to ask though is this a professional organization just for like economists with PhDs or seeking PhDs like grad students or is there involvement with undergrads? Sort of how broad is the outreach and membership?
That's a great question. So there are definitely membership options or tiers, right? Like welcome all, right? But we definitely have, you know, professional memberships that is for a PhD economist, whether you're working in academia, whether you're working in industry or think tanks or something like that.
That's important.
All are welcome. Yeah. And also have student memberships for graduate students. And we encourage graduate students to, you know, submit research for our panels and things like that. And we actually do have a lot of graduate students who attend. We have a summer conference joint with ASH, the American Society for Hispanic Economists. And we are getting engaged more right now with undergrads. So as part of an initiative over the past 2 years, brought on by two of our most recent past presidents, Benga Ajilore and Omari Swinton, we're doing student chapters, undergrad student chapters of the NEA, which are in some areas, I think like Atlanta is one of the first areas that we're looking to start it in and partnering with the Federal Reserve to help do some, you know, mentoring and sponsoring of some of the activities, but in more involved with undergrads and trying to get more undergrads.
That's great.
Interested in economics, right?
Yeah, that's awesome. I think I should have asked this question before, but can you tell our audience what is the NEA?
Sorry.
And we should think about this. Well, you know, whenever the first time I ever heard of National Economic Association, I literally thought that was like the AA.
Was the ASSA?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So maybe can you help us define what the NEA is in
the history? Yeah, so the NEA was actually established in 1969. We just celebrated our, you know, 50 years of the NEA. Thank you. And it was started as the Caucus of Black Economists.
Oh, okay.
Right? Yeah. And it was, you know, initially began as an effort to, I don't know, maybe sort of challenge the AEA to think a little bit more about, you know, race and opportunities for economists in the field. So
it's been going on for 50 years, everyone.
Yep, and we're still thinking about it. I don't know if you know, CIMGEP, the Committee for Minority Groups in the Economics Profession. I know
that's how you say it. I didn't
realize. CIMGEP.
This is a part of the hidden curriculum, which is the.
The acronym.
The way that the group pronounces the acronym. Because you never know from looking at it.
Right, because people don't say
NEA. Right,
NEA.
No. Yeah. Say NEA. Yeah, exactly.
Sound like an insider.
That's
yeah,
right.
Now you know, right? So CIMGEP was kind of an outgrowth of the organizing of the Caucus of Black Economists. And so eventually the Caucus of Black Economists became the National Economics Association. And they have a similar mission, which is obviously continue to increase opportunities for Black economists, but also more broadly to promote, you know, research and, you know, information on economics that affect the economic lives of Blacks in the U.S., right? And people of color as well. So I was just going to say, I think it's important to for folks to know that, right, like it's as an organization founded by Black economists, we're open to all, right?
Like, I was going to ask that question because people always like have that question. It's like, can I join, right? And I'm a member of NEA. And I guess people maybe don't know who I am.
Yeah, yes, but, you like, absolutely can join.
I am not Black American.
No, you do not have to be Black to join the National Economic Association. Mm-hmm. We welcome everyone. So
that's right. Great. Okay. I was just going to ask, let's say I love this and I want to join the NEA. What do I gain from my membership, or what is my membership to the NEA?
That's good. So as a grad student, first of all, your membership costs are half off. I should, you know, also I think it's good to just put it out there. Our membership cost for professional membership costs for 1 year, it's $50, right? So not very expensive for grad students. Right, exactly. So grad students, $25. And, you know, with some, you know, discounts for doing 3-year memberships. So for that low, low price, you get a subscription to the Review of Black Political Economy, which is the journal of the National Economic Association. You obviously you get access to, you know, the NEA Jobs Bulletin. You get access to, we have a newsletter, and then all of our networking opportunities, access to any scholarships, fellowships, and grants that we hear about and we, you know, we promote within the organization. And then also the NEA ASH summer conference, which is really great. It's really great for grad students. I have discovered over the years that lots of grad students have said they've gotten a lot of feedback on their research that's really helped them push, right?
Yeah. So. And one thing that I would mention is that I think you can join the NEA email list in theory for free, right? I highly recommend everyone to join that because they really send a lot of really great opportunities that, to be honest, sometimes I only hear from that list. And so highly recommend checking that out. Can you tell us a little bit about, you said networking opportunities that the NEA offers its members? What are some of those?
Yeah, so in addition to a annual networking reception at ASSA, the NEA will often have receptions and at some of the other regional economics meetings, like Southern's SEA, Southern Economic Association meetings. The NEA will sometimes have events there. Again, now we're doing, opportunities for mentoring and getting involved with the AEA's mentoring program. There's a good overlap in the, you know, personnel who are involved in the NEA along with the personnel who are involved in the AEA's summer program and mentoring programs. You know, just in general, having access to a community of people who are able to say, oh, you're interested in doing what? Oh, I know somebody who's interested in doing that, right? Like, right. So right. I think that has been a key thing for me in my career, at least.
And then I don't know if this is the same as the newsletter you mentioned, but when I was going through the NEA's website preparing for this, I found this like amazingly named newsletter that comes out called the Minority Report. Could you just describe sort of what happens in there and what goes on? Because just skimming the 2021, it's like really cool stuff is in here. Like it was talking about how errors in census counts affect federal spending and like walking through like, why does this matter? Who does this affect? Like, and like I learned something about like how like the census affects public spending in the U.S.
Yeah,
it's a pretty cool newsletter.
Yeah,
for a young audience, the Minority Report is a movie with Tom Cruise, and so that's why it's funny.
Yeah, and it teaches us about the dangers of presupposing.
Very important right now. Okay, yeah. So tangent.
Go ahead. So this is the precogs. It's great. It's a great movie.
So the Minority Report, I think it began in 2008, and it's actually another one of those joint ventures between NEA, ASH, and SimGep. Again, so that, you know, SimGep represents the AEA's involvement in it. And so one of the things that that happens in the Minority Report is, you know, really interesting, just like you just mentioned that article, like interesting research. I think in one of the more recent ones, Rhonda Sharp had some really interesting information about, you know, disaggregating data, just like you were talking about the census data and errors. Also, like the importance of disaggregating data, because when we report aggregated data, we don't get a lot of the, you know, clear indication of what's going on with certain populations, right? Mm-hmm. So just like another, you know, free source of information relevant to people who are interested in, you know, the economic standing of, you know, Blacks in the U.S., Hispanics in the U.S., and so on.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think you know, it's funny. I'm on Twitter, and a lot of people, you know, talk a lot about, oh, we need a lot more information, and people need, you know, we need to do more research on this topic. There's actually been a lot of people who've been doing a lot of research for a while, yes, and a lot of like interesting fun facts and finding. And I think the Minority Report, and it's a nice PDF, has a lot of this cool bite-sized pieces. So if you're legit interested in that, go check it out, read it, download it, make comments, email, and whatever. There's like a really amazing set of people working on it. So
can I add, since you brought that up, this is a great point that, because I'm on Twitter too, and a lot of people will ask, you know, interesting questions about, especially given what was happening this summer and, you know, this revival and interest in topics of race and discrimination, do this study or whatever. 9 times out of 10, the thing that you're interested in has had some attention paid to it in the review of Black political economy. So I would say encourage, you know, this is my sort of public service announcement. Like, I encourage you, if you're interested in something that involves, you know, research surrounding race, do a search in the review of Black political economy first. So there you can, you know, find some really good footing, right, to build from, I think.
And also in the Journal of Race and Uncertainty, or Economics, Race and Policy, I think.
That's right.
Gary Hoover runs it.
That's exactly right.
I totally agree with that. Like, there's been a lot of like interesting work there that I feel like I see there, and I don't see in other places, that it would be great to highlight.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for those insights. Every week, we like to ask our guests for a recommendation of the week. It can be anything you want. It could be like a brand of clothes, a song, State of Command. The only one time it's been a State of Command, but I always use that in my list of examples, so maybe I had to change it up. A recipe tip, that's a frequent tip of the week. Anything that improves your life in a small way.
So. Oh, that's a really good... So here's a testament to, again, how odd I am. When you said that, the first thing that came to mind was... advice never to put fats, oil, or grease, and that includes cheese, down your drain. It'll clog up your drains. You'll end up playing a plumber so much. So if you've cooked something, you know, like people can imagine not pouring a whole thing of grease down their drain, but they don't even think if you've got gravy left over, that's fats. Like, you're supposed to, you know, put it in plastic and throw it away.
Solid cheese is fine.
No, solid cheese is not fine. Do not
put down your drain.
Down your drain.
You put solid cheese down your drain. First of all, why do you have leftovers?
Yeah. First of all, why are we judging me?
Who doesn't eat every cheese possible?
Exactly. So remember though, fog, fats, oil, and grease. Don't put them down your drain.
Okay, that's a great helpful tip, because I did not know that.
You're welcome.
Like, I knew about the oil, but not about the fats and the
it sounds like you learned an expensive lesson based off of the, like,
not me. Not me. I'm just super, didn't we already talk about the fact that I have all these checklists? I'm just a preparer, and I'm so super prepared about things and always planning for the worst contingencies.
Can I push you to give a second tip of the week and talk about your earbuds?
That's how, so I have to, like,
I think this is genius. So two people in your household, or at least two sets of AirPods exist, and you have like put a really like tastefully done tape around them. They kind of look like earrings. So your AirPods are blue, whereas maybe your partner's or your other set are untaped or green or something. I don't know, but I think it's a pretty good identification solution.
That's right. It's part of, I guess maybe the part of my background that doesn't know how to share.
It's like in your ear. All right.
I know. That's right. I claim all of my things by doing things like putting colorful tape on them to let people know in my house, these are mine. Don't lose them.
I love it. All right, Sebastian, you're up next.
My recommendation of the week is for everyone to go check a YouTube channel. It's run by this guy. His name is Ali Abdal, and he is an MD in the UK. And he started just doing a YouTube channel about being an MD and studying for tests and whatever. But it's turned out about to this like productivity channel where he talks about a bunch of stuff. And I think his videos are great. I think he gets to the point. I think he says it in a style that it speaks to me. And, you know, it's been the first time that I've been influenced by an influencer. So he has this keyboard, and I love this keyboard, and I bought this keyboard, which my listeners cannot see it. But it's a beautiful keyboard. I'll put a picture on Twitter.
I imagine we could probably hear the keyboard, though. It's a fancy mechanical keyboard. Cool. Is that the blue switches on there?
Cherry blue, that's right.
Cherry blue.
Yeah exactly. So anyways, check. I'll put a link on the description. Wait, I'm trying to do fancy stuff here. And check for Ali Abdal.
Alex, what does the keyboard do? I'm sorry.
Oh, it's just a Bluetooth keyboard that looks good, but it also has RGB lights. So like you can't see it right now because there's, but you can see it's kind of green. Let me turn off the lights.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah. That's awesome. I see the light.
Is that a K-Cron?
I don't know. But it's also mechanical. So like some people like mechanical keyboards because that. And I love that. I just love it. So
I like that.
Alex, what's your recommendation of the week?
So mine is going to be super cooking related. So I enjoy cooking, and I'm reasonable at following instructions when it comes to cooking. But like when I was learning to cook and they were like, is the meat well done? Or is even like the potato cooked? I'd be like, I don't know.
Yeah. Let me bite it and I'll figure it out.
I would like cut into it. So just buy a cheap kitchen thermometer that goes in. And I have one that's magnetic and it just goes on the fridge. And I feel like maybe they're coming over for dinner, so they're just nice. But people compliment my food now. Whereas before, I feel like they were like, to be polite, where I'm like, I feel like I consistently can cook meat and things the way that I want it now.
Okay. I cook steak for the first time in my life, like the American thick steak this week. And all the recipes were like, check the temperature, check. And I was like, I don't have a meat thermometer, so we're just going to go live. We're just going to go raw here. Like,
so which way did you go? Were you eating like blood, or did you like, was it like I was style, well done, with ketchup?
I'm from Latin America, which means I eat it really burnt. So I was a little on the burnt side. I'm sorry. But I'm starting to eat more red meat. It's just so weird.
Burnt? Do you mean well done?
Yes, well done.
Okay,
well
right. Done. Sorry, that wasn't like burned. But people, like a char
people
is good.
Really get upset that I'm eating well done steak, right? Like,
people do. People have feelings about it.
People have feelings. I will get canceled. That's fine. Not the first time, but you know, I was kidding.
Not the first time. Something happened in Peru we need to know about.
That's why I left.
Oh no!
All right. Well, I think that's all we have today. I really appreciate having you on here today. Is there anywhere, or could you list the places where listeners could find more information about you, about your work, or about anything else that you'd love to share?
Oh, awesome. I'm on Twitter at Dania Francis, D-A-N-I-A Francis. And my website is daniafrancis.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And thank you everyone for tuning in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.